Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. This week, Professor Elliot Cohen examines the relationship between Harry S. Truman and General Douglas MacArthur. In 1951, during the Korean War, President Truman relieved General MacArthur of his command. This class is from Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. It's just over an hour.
Okay, let's get launched. So the course is The Art of Strategic Decision, and today we've been talking about choosing subordinates. We've really been talking about civil-military relations. And just to establish the background, thus far we've talked about the nature of strategic choice. We've talked about the environment of strategic choice, including the psychological environment. We've discussed the most critical choice of all, which is the decision to go to war. And we've had a crisis exercise. The class just before this, we had a general discussion of civil-military relations. And now we're going to go into a case, perhaps the most famous case of all, the Truman-MacArthur controversy. And let's start at the most dramatic point, a statement by the President, April 10th, 1951. With deep regret, I have concluded that General of the Army Douglas MacArthur is unable to give his wholehearted support to the policies of the United States government and of the United Nations in matters pertaining to his official duties. In view of the specific responsibilities imposed upon me by the Constitution of the United States, and the added responsibility which has been entrusted to me by the United Nations, I have decided that I must make a change of command in the Far East. I have therefore relieved General MacArthur of his commands and have designated Lieutenant General Matthew B. Ridgway as his successor. Full and vigorous debate on matters of national policy is a vital element in the constitutional system of our free democracy. It is fundamental, however, that military commanders must be governed by the policies and directives issued to them in the manner provided by our laws and Constitution. In time of crisis, this consideration is particularly compelling. General MacArthur's place in history as one of our greatest commanders is fully established. The nation owes him a debt of gratitude for the distinguished and exceptional service which he has rendered his country in posts of great responsibility. For that reason, I repeat my regret at the necessity for the action I feel compelled to take in his case. So the question is, how did we get to here, and what do we make of it? Let me just begin by running through with you very quickly the chronology of the Korean War, and then we'll go into what is the nature of the clash between Truman and MacArthur. So the war begins on June 25th, 1950, with the North Koreans crossing the 38th parallel, driving the South Koreans and a small American force into a perimeter around Pusan Harbor. The United States commits. It becomes a United Nations intervention. And throughout that summer, there's a lot of very difficult fighting. All this, of course, being run by Douglas MacArthur as Commander-in-Chief Far East out of Tokyo, about 700 miles away from the Korean Peninsula, let's recall. On the civil-military relations side, on August 24th, 1950, so really right in the thick of this, he gives his Veterans of Foreign War speech, where the issue is not Korea, it's Taiwan, or as they then called it, Formosa. We'll get back to that. September 10th through the 19th, the Incheon landings. This is the famous left hook on the Korean peninsula. It's accompanied at the same time by a breakout from the Pusan perimeter. The North Korean military is pretty much shattered. By the 11th, President Truman has ordered the crossing of the 38th parallel, and American forces are moving north. On October 15th in particular, there is a conference between President Truman and General MacArthur on Wake Island in the middle of the Pacific. And the topic, of course, is what are we going to do next? North Korean forces are being pushed back. Do you go all the way up to the Yalu? What is the conflict going to look like? Although we should talk about what really is discussed at Wake. And as American forces are getting closer and closer to the Yalu River, which is the border with China, the Chinese come into the war. Now, there had been an early minor offensive in October, but on November 25th, on Thanksgiving, the Chinese come in a big way, and it is pretty calamitous. American forces are pushed back. By December 5th, Pyongyang, which had been occupied, is abandoned, and American forces continue to fall back. At the end of December, just before Christmas, in fact, the commander of 8th Army, Walton Walker, is killed in a traffic accident. One of those accidents which actually has huge consequences for future history, because he gets replaced by Matthew B. Ridgway, Vice Chief of Staff of the Army, and ultimately MacArthur's successor. We then have the series of letters, which you've seen, MacArthur's letter to Speaker Martin, the Joint Chiefs of Staff kind of slapping him down, March 24th, the statement that MacArthur issues to the New York Times, and then April 10th, the firing of MacArthur. So let me just begin to open up the discussion by asking you this. What exactly is the nature of the clash between MacArthur and Truman? Is this a clash over policy? Is this a problem of personalities? Is this just that he didn't have a real good public affairs officer saying, boss, this may not be the right time to give that speech? What is it that's going on here? Monica.
I think it was interesting because the clash seems both personality and policy.
It's both personality and policy.
Because considering MacArthur having such a strong characteristic in that age, at that time of period, definitely played a role, and also Truman feeling sensitive about that emotion is where the personality clash, I believe, happened. In regards to the policy, if MacArthur didn't have such a strong policy approach or perspective, clash wouldn't have appeared. But then again, that disagreement had been there, and that's where I believe the clash. So I think both definitely played a role in this specific clash.
Okay, well, let's, Mick, yeah.
I was going to say, I mean, there's several levels. I mean, there's the personality piece where, you know, MacArthur's pretty much the ruler of Japan and Truman's the ruler of the United States, and they're both used to pretty much getting their own way strategically, so there's that clash, and neither of them really want to take responsibility for big decisions over Korea. But on the policy side, MacArthur obviously sees himself as better placed to see what's going on in Asia and the danger of China and the role of Formosa and all those kind of things, whereas those kind of concerns don't seem to be front and centre in the US as much as they are in MacArthur's mind. So I think, you know, like Monica said, there's both the personality and the policy side there.
Okay, why don't we flesh out we'll flesh out the personality side, and then I want to flesh out the policy side. Chris. Okay, go ahead.
On the policy side, I think in addition to the sort of policy disagreement or different perceptions, there's also the political component. I think MacArthur was very much conscious of his own popularity, his own legend, and of Truman's somewhat tenuous political situation, and that certainly played a role in how far he thought he could push it, particularly in actively engaging in the political process, but also in sort of the messaging.
Okay, well let's build on that. Let's build on the personality side of it, because that's the way where you've taken us, and then we'll go to the policy issues. So what are some of the big personality differences between these guys? Yeah, Matt.
Truman is, from his own experience, is deeply suspicious of the regular officer corps versus, I guess, his experience in the reserves. And MacArthur is kind of trying to avoid the sins of his father and, being a great leader, a great military commander, and successfully navigating the political dynamics that requires as well, which his father didn't successfully do.
Yeah, I mean, you do see in many ways that the clash between the citizen-soldier tradition and a certain variant of the regular. Truman he was a captain in the National Guard during World War I, commanded an artillery battery, did very well, actually, by all accounts, was a good commander. People have argued that until he became a senator, in some ways the most successful part of his life was being a battery commander on the Western Front in the First World War. Most of his other adventures didn't really turn out that well. So he had a very strong sense of that. Also a strong sense of history. Who are his heroes? Andrew Jackson. Okay? again, a very sort of citizen soldier type. And then you're right. I mean, Douglas MacArthur's father is a famous but embittered Civil War general. So he's carrying quite a load. By the way, his mother stayed right there at West Point all the time that he was there to kind of keep an eye on Doug. So there are all kinds of interesting psychological issues there. I gather that's not done all that much. What other aspects of the personality would you say? Yeah, Connor.
Also, the Far East, East Asia, Western Pacific, whatever you want to call it, that's sort of been MacArthur's playground for the better part of two decades or so.
Right.
So I think he's sort of gotten this sense of, no, this is my land.
Right.
You may be the president, but I'm in charge here.
Yeah. Does anybody remember how long it was since he'd been back in the continental United States? 13 years. Actually, it's 14 by the time he gets back home, before he's touched foot in the continental United States. And MacArthur had a difficult personality. The story is told, and this may be, it may be apocryphal, as chief of staff of the Army during the early phases of the Roosevelt administration, he was fighting back very hard against budget cuts. Nothing new there. And Roosevelt, who would always try to charm people, would say, Doug. And he would always, his generals hated it, but he would use their first names, except with Marshall. He eventually called him General Marshall. So he said, Doug, you know, why are you getting so excited about this? And MacArthur is reputed to have said, whether or not this is true, that because, Mr. President, when the last American boy lies dying with an enemy boot on his neck and an enemy bayonet in his gut, I want the last dying words of his dying curse to be Roosevelt rather than MacArthur. And Roosevelt said, you can't speak to the President of the United States that way. And at least according to the story, MacArthur then leaves and throws up on the steps of the White House, which is probably a pretty good reaction, all things considered. Okay, so we have these very distinctive personalities, which we've portrayed. And now, again, just on the Truman point, remember, Truman has this tremendous reverence for George C. Marshall, who can't stand Douglas MacArthur and vice versa. There's an interesting story there, too. And one of the things to remember about generals, they don't get along. I mean, these are solitary beasts. They tend to hunt alone. I once said to somebody in government, there's a troop of deer and a pride of lions. The collective for generals should be a jealousy of generals, and that's sort of what they were like. And Marshall and MacArthur did not get along. Okay, but what are the policy differences? What are the policy issues? We can dispense with the idea that simply that Marshall wanted to go up to the Yalu and nobody else did. Was that true? Was that his idea? No. Okay. I mean, everybody kind of agreed with that. So what exactly were the policy issues? Mick?
I got a sense that MacArthur was really focused on taking on China at some point, whether it was over Korea, whether it was over Formosa, but he felt that there was this coming battle, and I don't get the sense Truman saw it that way. And especially when it came to the employment of nuclear weapons, MacArthur was an advocate, whereas Truman had already made that decision once before. He actually understood very clearly the implications of making a decision about the use of nuclear weapons and was far less keen to use nuclear weapons than, say, someone like MacArthur was.
Yeah, I mean, was MacArthur going to throw nuclear weapons around without political authorization?
No, but he was happy to advocate that use.
Well, that's military advice.
Not in the New York Times.
But that in and of itself may have been part of his, that may have been a tactical, sort of a political tactic in sort of advocating, the later madman theory. I mean, I think there was an element of, I'm advocating this just to sort of push the bounds of what, those on the other side of the divide are thinking.
Okay, so is all this, Yeah, Louis.
But the main conflict is not what the policy is, it's who makes the policy.
Well, but is MacArthur really fighting over who gets to make policy? I mean, does he ever say, you know, Mr. President, I get to make the decisions out here? I mean, it seems to me, you know, he's formally, at least formally, he's pretty subordinate, isn't he? Paul?
I think at his heart, he was not on board with the policy of fighting a limited war. His speeches constantly return to the theme of expanding this, his hands tied behind his back. We need to go after China. We need to get the nationalists involved. And when he stretched the limit on orders, like putting U.S. and allied troops more towards the border of the Yalu River, again, he was chafing at the bit of being restrained, I think.
Okay, but look, again, to be fair to him, he got authorization for that, right? To go up to the Yalu. Josh?
We're back up to Incheon. I mean, he withheld his plans for the Incheon landing just long enough to where he knew that they couldn't give him any guidance. Because he ascertained that they might not either agree with the tactics of the plan or agree with the strategy overall. So it was held close to the vest until it was obviously too late and the landings went ahead. The landings were successful. He had lived a life of this type of action, and he was legendary for it, and the cult of personality played into just what we're talking about.
Right,
but that's a policy issue, the fact that he is circumventing the system.
Well, how is he circumventing the system? I mean, before Incheon, I believe he's visited by Collins and Forrest Sherman. So, I mean, he gets a visit from the JCS. The Joint Chiefs of Staff, you know, send their emissaries out there, and they sort of know what the plan is. They're not happy about it, but he is the commander. I mean, what's...
It's my understanding he wasn't given the full go-ahead, and there were steps that were left to be taken. Understand, I mean, there's issues in the Joint Chiefs, but...
But, I mean, would you really want to have the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you know, designing your operations plan for, you know, when you're launching, I don't know what operation you're going to end up launching, but, you know, the invasion of Antarctica. I mean, you know, there's General Richardson and, you know...
It doesn't matter what I want. If there's a system in place to circumvent it, is starting to make policy.
I think another, really the primary issue is the subordination of the military to civilian authority. That, you know, we're taught from the very beginning that unless you're being ordered to do something that's illegal, immoral, or unethical, that you execute the strategy as given to you by civilian leadership. And General MacArthur clearly had differences of opinion, but he made his differences of opinion a little bit more well-known than is strictly, I think, allowed for by the military profession.
Bobby.
The issue of subordination, his insubordination came, he was kind of the master of the leak. He was the master of the speech, kind of ex parte speech. It talked about how he had seduced, in the readings, naval officers by allowing them to have access, not by shutting them out, but by allowing them to have access. So he was massaging the process in a very delicate way without actually confronting the command authority. So his insubordination was
But look, he's allowing access. He allows naval officers access to him. The Navy Arleigh Burke, who's a great naval leader, right, loved the guy. And, by the way, he gets fantastic cooperation from the United States Navy. I mean, as the readings point out, MacArthur conducts more amphibious operations, and I would point out successful amphibious operations, than any other commander during the Second World War. So all you're telling me is that he's really competent. Dean.
He has a history of pretty much just acting on his own initiative that came from his father, who, I mean, his father became famous by disobeying orders and taking a hill, even when he was told to just break through, just get to the first line and stop.
All right, but hold on a second.
And then he did the same thing with the Philippines in defense of it. And he was told repeatedly that, you know, here's the plan we have set up. Do not meet them at the beach. And he still met them at the beach, and he lost.
We were going to lose the Philippines anyhow. I mean, the thing that they...
But he was kept arguing that the Philippines needed to be protected.
Well, but then isn't the problem with the people who didn't relieve him a lot earlier? Right? I mean, if if you've conditioned somebody to be able to get away with this, then I don't understand what the problem is. But I mean, really seriously, I want to think about what is it that MacArthur did. MacArthur's move to the Yalu was approved by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The Incheon operation was approved by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He did not, you know, invade China. He didn't conduct military operations against China from Taiwan, or Formosa, as he then called it. He did not begin bombing China. It's not that he actually did things which expanded the war, which people often think of as what he did. His problem was elsewhere, Louis.
It seems like his career built up this reputation that created this sort of adjunct system of deference from within the military and even with the civilian authorities that impacted how policy was made.
So you mean it's his command style?
Possibly that, maybe some of it, his background, but Truman traveling out to visit with him, it was that deference was obvious, that the Incheon landing, you know, he drove that.
What's the issue with Truman going out to Wake Island?
Well, before the election, and he had political power, and he wanted to take advantage of that political power. So there's a blurred line.
Well, can we flip it in the other direction and say that Truman is going out to Wake Island, not actually to confer about strategy, that's already been done, but so that he can look like the commander-in-chief before the 1950 election. So is the problem Truman?
Well, MacArthur was very aware of what Truman wanted, and he used that as an opportunity to push policy more in the direction that he preferred.
Okay, I'm trying to find out why I'm supposed to be as troubled as I'm supposed to be. Eunice.
I think MacArthur noticed, he was so far away from the decision-making center. So he was sending signals, but in some kind of distortions were happening in here. For instance, we know Dean Acheson's, Secretary of State's efforts to distort his messages to the president. So there are also some joint chief of staff members who are not agree with MacArthur. But the Incheon success provided, somehow covered these things.
Right.
Up until failure come to the on table.
That's a really important point. Okay. Obviously, I've been kind of pushing it precisely because the standard narrative is so anti-MacArthur. I wanted to push you a little bit in the opposite direction. But I mean, Eunice, you just put your finger on why is it hard to control this guy? First, he has this incredible record in World War II. I gave you this excerpt from Ridgway's book on the Korean War, and Ridgway was very critical of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for not reining MacArthur in. I mean, he thought this was, he didn't quite say dereliction of duty, but he had a very harsh view of it, including, by the way, a harsh view of Marshall for not who succeeds Louis Johnson for not being a lot tougher on MacArthur. Even though Marshall and MacArthur couldn't abide one another, Marshall's view was, hey, he's the theater commander. I'm not going to micromanage him. But so you have Ridgway, who's very critical. Notice two things about this excerpt. He said, I'd first known him in the 1920s when I was a young captain at West Point and he was superintendent. Okay, so that means MacArthur was a general officer and Ridgway was a captain. And in those days, the gap between a captain and a general officer, even bigger than it is today. So imagine the psychological barrier that he has to get over. But the other thing is, he says, whatever his problems, he was a, quote, truly great military man, a great statesman, and a gallant leader. And when fate suddenly decided that I would serve directly under him in Korea, I welcomed the chance to associate once again with one of the few geniuses it has been my privilege to know. Now, whether or not he actually was a genius is debatable, actually. And the military historians tend to have a more negative view of MacArthur. But there's clearly something about that person, the personality of MacArthur, that made people go, wow, this is somebody very, very hard to contradict. Dean.
But that was only some people. On the other hand, you have Eisenhower, who served under him, hated him.
Yes. Eisenhower couldn't stand him. Of course, Eisenhower was part of the Marshall the Marshall clique. Mick?
I was just going to go back to, you know, why Truman had a problem with MacArthur. And I mean, MacArthur had this amazing advocacy program going in Washington where, you know, he reached out to congressmen, to the press and to VFWs and a whole bunch of other folks that were a pseudo-lobbying organisation for him to influence policy in Washington, D.C. So why he wasn't always
doing... The difference between that and David Petraeus?
That's a really good question.
That's why I asked it. Did David Petraeus have connections with, you know, think tanks and academics?
I'm sure there were some connections there, but given we're talking about MacArthur,
no, seriously, what's the, you know, the question we're getting at is what's over the line and what's not over the line.
Well, I get the sense Truman thought what MacArthur was doing, the way he was doing that pseudo lobbying, is that was the realm of what, that's what politicians do, that's what civilians do. The military aren't supposed to do that in the way he conceives the civil military relationship.
Chris.
MacArthur is a political threat. I mean, the one thing General Petraeus doesn't have is 16 million people just out of uniform in the last 5 years. Yeah. I mean, in a society that's about 180, 185 million, yeah. I mean, that's a huge chunk of society that identifies with a World War II war hero, a World War I war hero. And so he's this larger-than-life, not just in the political-military sense, it's the nation. So...
By the way, this is call me paranoid, but why exactly do you think the Obama administration was really eager to make General Petraeus director of Central Intelligence? And do you think they would have done that in 2013? I wonder. So the idea, and I mean, I think part of what fireproofed Petraeus to some extent was he has repeatedly been Sherman-esque in saying, no, I have no political interest. MacArthur, not so much. MacArthur, not so much. I want to move us on. Okay. So at what point, let me just take a quick poll. How many of you would have fired MacArthur? How many would not have fired MacArthur? Good. Okay. I'm going to want to hear from you guys. Let's start with you. Derek, let me put you on the spot. Why wouldn't you have fired MacArthur?
I think he had some brilliant points that if you could rein him in, I mean, you don't necessarily have to fire him, but you have to give him clear guidelines. I think, especially at Wake Island, Truman tried to utilize that to capitalize on political credibility and associate himself and the Democrats with the success of Incheon and the Pusan breakout. So he was really more focused on capitalizing on that than reigning in MacArthur. And I think had he had a more open discourse with MacArthur and kind of laid down the line, you might have seen some changes.
Just curious, how would you have done that? I mean, if you were, let's say... You know, you've got this great SAIS-MA, greatest school of international relations on the planet. And you've been picked, as SAIS students so often are, to be advisors to presidents. And he has picked you and he's asked you, he said, okay, tell me how I'm going to... You've said, we need to rein this guy in. Tell me, what's the best way of reining in a Douglas MacArthur?
It's not easy.
No.
I think you almost bring him within inside the fold to kind of engage him to where he feels he has some stake at the table to determine the actual, where his strategy is nested with the policy that you're trying to achieve.
So you'd be kind of hug him. Okay, Dana.
Yeah, I think you maybe hug him, but I think you appeal to his professionalism. I mean, he is, when you strip it all down, I mean, he really is a professional soldier. I know, granted, when Truman landed on Wake Island, he didn't salute him, and he shook his hand and,
not good.
Didn't go to lunch with him and kind of played that game. But just as how MacArthur failed, he he was playing his own game. I think Truman and the civilian leaders, and in particular, too, the Joint Chiefs, they failed to recognize that there was a game they needed to play with MacArthur. And had they recognized where they could actually approach him and where he does tend to listen, they didn't exploit that. And
okay, let me just, again, to follow up the question that I asked Eric, and how exactly would you have gone about doing that?
I think he does well in probably a close setting type meeting. Yeah. With senior leaders, like so, people that are as close to his
military or civilian. Would you have sent? I mean, would you have sent?
He needs to talk to Truman. That's the way. It's someone that's a.
And how do you arrange that?
Well, just when Truman went to go visit him at Wake, I think Truman at that point, he's the commander in chief, needs to pull him aside. Said, "Listen, here's the situation."
So Truman should have read him the riot act at Wake.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Now Matt was shaking his head the whole time you were talking, so I'm going to put Matt on the spot.
On the specific question, how do you do it? I don't think this is a matter of putting MacArthur in a room with anybody. I think it's you just take him out of command of, like...
You just think the only
solution... You don't necessarily fire him, but you promote him, move him to a different... I think he's been too long at this point in the Far East, and there has got to be a job for him in Washington that you can... You can get him back. I mean, like, if you want to know how... That's how I would get him back inside the box, so to speak. Because, I mean, he's been there for a long time. He not only is a personality and people defer to him, perhaps wrongly, but he also sees China fundamentally different than, like, the Truman administration sees China. I mean, Truman is looking at Formosa and what's happening there in the context that we've got to keep the UN on board. And Truman, or MacArthur, excuse me, is saying, you know, they respond to force. We have to go there. We have to show them, like, this is our bulwark against China. There's just fundamental difference of opinion. So I would have gotten rid of him. But it's not for insubordination, as other people are saying, because he's not disobeying orders. It's just he sees it differently.
So you would have just – at what point would you – I'm just curious now, because as I'll begin probing with those of you who are in favor of relief – at what point would you have relieved him? You're now advising Truman.
I think he
fired Derek. He's hired you.
I think he should have been relieved before Wake Island. I mean, after the Formosa thing.
You would have relieved him before Wake Island. At what point? As soon as you come into office, or?
No, I think after the Formosa comment. After his speech to the
After his speech to the veterans of foreign wars. Now, let's just remind ourselves, when does that take place? It's the end of August. Things are desperate in the Pusan perimeter. Things are desperate. I mean, you're just kind of restoring some equilibrium. You think, you know, this may be the Joint Chiefs of Staff think this may be the beginning of the big one, right? And so you're also thinking about how do we reinforce Europe in case the balloon goes up there. Would you be willing to advise the president to relieve this incredibly popular war hero while you're still just kind of hanging on?
Maybe not, but perhaps at Wake Island. The tide has turned by the time you get, or somewhat turned at least, by the time you actually get to Wake Island, so much so that the president wants a photo op with you. I mean...
So the president, okay, so you would have fired him at Wake Island?
Maybe. Yes. I think so.
Politically. Okay. If we fire him at Wake just before we're going into an election, and the Republicans are going to say, you may well be right. Actually, I tend to my personal view. You're right on all the merits. The thing to do would be to get rid of the guy to begin with. But if you fire him at Wake, you're going to kill yourself in the general election, not general, but the general election. So it's hard to and the guy's been successful. He's just pulled off this incredibly brilliant military coup, you know, which he tells the Marines, by the way, will guarantee your future for another century. So Chris is very happy. It's really hard to fire him then too. I mean, this is part of the problem. Firing someone who completely screws up, that's, I wouldn't say easy, but it's not as hard. Josh.
To the question of how do you go about retaining him, I think it's important that it would have been important for Truman to spend some time developing a coalition of people in Washington to move with him. He doesn't have the military gravitas. He's the president of the United States, but MacArthur's not biting on a whole lot of that. if he creates a group to travel with him, to buy into the vision of, I mean, if he talks to Marshall about putting, Marshall, put your hatred for MacArthur aside. I need you with me, and I need you to pull him to me. Now you're achieving some parity, and you might be able to retain the general. That work wasn't done.
So you would have tried to keep MacArthur.
Essentially, I mean, I think it's your job to try to retain
but
him.
But you say at some point you would have fired him. At what point would you have fired him?
At the Yalu. As he exceeded the limitations that were given him towards China out of his personal policy.
But, you know.
And essentially when he, and I know that amounts to basically when he was fired, but.
That's not what he's fired for, actually. Cole.
I think that the optimal time politically to fire him would have been when Ridgway had assumed command of the 8th Army, was making advances north of the 38th parallel, and MacArthur was not as popular in the ranks at the time, and Ridgway was becoming more of a figure seen in the Army.
Well, that's sort of what they do. I mean, they wait for – and Ridgway, by the way, the story of Ridgway turning around 8th Army is a fantastic tale of military leadership. For those of you who are interested in such things, I mean, it's really Eighth Army has been feeling kind of is a defeated army, and Ridgway turns them around. And then, of course, they put him in, and he ends up replacing MacArthur and doing very well. Other people who would fire him, and when you would fire him, and how you would fire him, Bobby.
I would fire him. I would fire. I think the timing was perfect for Truman because. After the Yalu, the next thing was Wake, but things were turning better at Wake. Truman, by his own admission, even though he wasn't saluted, he got stood up for lunch. Truman walked away saying, "I like the guy," but MacArthur had been put under, which is phenomenal to me, that he'd been put under a gag order by the JCS. Don't talk about U.S. foreign policy. Watch what you say. Clear things through us. And yet he continued to leak. There continued to be leaks through the press. And then finally he reaches out, or was reached out to by the Speaker of the House. And
he's not going to respond to the Speaker of the House?
But he crossed the line. He's making U.S. foreign policy kind of parallel to regular U.S. foreign policy. At that point, he has crossed a line, a non-bright line, but he's crossed the line.
Is there anybody here who's sympathetic to MacArthur on his response to Joseph Martin? No. Monica is.
I think part of the large problem between the two people, going back to that original question, because I think it's all related to how it happened, is that misinterpretation and limited communication, I think, is a big problem of why their clash has developed. Because, for instance, even though both played a very important role in the Korean War, neither have met up until the midpoint, actually, of that war. And that was a problem because MacArthur was hearing about Truman of an image that he hasn't met until that point. So he had an image of understanding Truman from what he heard from his people. Likewise, about MacArthur, Truman had that image. And I think that also complicated when they met. They couldn't really trust each other. And when they didn't trust each other, when they were doing their works both in D.C. and in Asia, it just became bigger. So
let me ask this question. That's a really interesting point, Monica. You know, today on your desk in Pentagon, you'll have a computer screen, and you can, if you're senior enough, you can press a button, and lo and behold, you know, the combatant commander in Tokyo or wherever they are pops up on the screen. And in the situation in the room in the White House, they're doing video teleconferences all the time. Would video teleconferencing have made this problem go away or reduced it to such an extent that you could manage it the way a number of you clearly feel that it would be worth retaining MacArthur if you could? Connor?
First of all, I do agree if you could keep him on board, that'd be great. He's clearly very competent. But I'm frankly in line with what Bobby said earlier, that he's a leaky ship. They've told him to shut up. He refused to do so. And so he has to go. I think, in fact, video teleconferencing would make it worse because he could talk to so many more people easier.
Well, can you imagine what Douglas MacArthur would have done with email? My goodness. Megan.
he wasn't summoned to Washington. I think now we're all, I mean, some of it is ease of travel, but I think now we're all a lot more used to the somewhat subtle message that is sent when a president summons a general officer to Washington. And, you know, maybe that's a lesson learned from
although even their technology plays a role. You know, you'd get there a lot more quickly in a G5 than in, I don't know what kind of transports they were using back in 1950, but my guess is it was probably a 2 or 3 day journey to in each direction, which means, you know, quite apart from what happens here when you get here, it's almost a week gone for a theater commander, which is a lot. Yeah, Dana.
Yeah, so, I mean, it goes back to my point. That's why I think on Wake Island, a face-to-face discussion between Truman and MacArthur needed to happen. I mean, MacArthur already, you know, explains, you know, in his communique and talks how he views Japan and just the Asian society as a society that deals, they need to be forcefully dealt with. I mean, that's a huge indicator on his own personality. He needs to be forcefully dealt with. That just never happened face-to-face. It happened through letters from the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They should have recognized that this individual does not respond to that type of communication. And I think once that communication is made, if he does not change his tune, then you can start talking about, hey, we need to find somebody else.
Right. Well, of course, I mean, part of what happens is, and again, to set the context, is MacArthur says things which we would consider racist, but which would have been pretty common currency at the time. People would have believed. I mean, today it reads pretty horrifically that if he said, if we don't defend Formosa, then those who speak thus do not understand. This is from the VFW speech. Those who speak thus do not understand the Orient. They do not grant that it is in the pattern of the Oriental psychology, I like that, the single, Oriental psychology, to respect and follow aggressive, resolute, and dynamic leadership, namely me, to quickly turn on a leadership characterized by timidity or vacillation, and they underestimate the Oriental mentality. So, now again, we read this today, we say racist, and yeah, in large measure it is, but that would have been a not uncommon kind of thing for senior people, and not just MacArthur, to believe. So, you know, we have to take that into account. And he is viewed as, appropriately, the guy who's been running Japan very successfully. I mean, you know, when we occupy Japan, do we really think this is going to be easy? And MacArthur seems to have done a brilliant job of it.
Thinking back to the...
and then I'm going to get to you. Yeah, but Chris.
Thinking back to kind of the video teleconference and what he could have done up to firing him, I think that, I'm reminded of Lincoln's, the letter he sent to Hooker basically saying, you know, I'll risk a dictatorship if you win some battles.
Right.
And I think, you know, obviously not a VTC at the time, but sort of some sort of direct démarche,
right,
essentially saying, you know, cease and desist, with the subtle implicit message being, you know, you're a very public guy. Firing you, you know, 60 years later, students are going to be talking about it. So,
The reference, by the way, is, for those of you who are not familiar with it, before Lincoln, of course, goes through a whole bunch of generals. And just before he appoints Joe Hooker, who is reported to have said that what the country really needs is a dictator. Lincoln writes him this fantastic letter, which basically says, look, I've chosen you. Now let me tell you something. You undercut your predecessor, and I understand that you've been going around saying the country needs a dictator. And that's not really on, but, you know, if you give me the victories, I'll run the risk of the dictator. And then he says, so here's what I want you to do. I want you to go forward. I want you to be vigilant. I want you to be aggressive. But, you know, go forth with my support. It is a brilliant, brilliant letter. It was only found in Hooker's papers after Hooker died. People hadn't realized that Lincoln had actually sent that letter. And it is a very direct communication, which is really not just, here's what I'm telling you to do, but from my money, the thing that's really brilliant about it is it's, I see right through you. I know exactly what kind of guy you are. And was establishing dominance in a way that I think Truman would have found hard to do. I mean, this really gets to the personality of the politician and to what extent Lincoln could have, who, without being a kind of a grandiose figure in any way, did have this fantastic ability to kind of assert his dominance that very few other politicians have had.
I think people miss it. I think people misunderestimate, President Truman. I mean, here was
so
a guy
speak,
who,
yes.
was, you know, his entire career, yes. He had been, underestimated. He had been, called yes. James Pendergast's boy in the Senate, and then he gets there and he operates, completely independently.
Oh, yes.
The minute he assumed the presidency, he assumed it. He operated independently. He threatened to beat up a guy who criticized his daughter's piano playing. I mean, Truman was actually fairly.
I'm not sure that's necessarily a mark of a good president.
Truman was actually a fairly self-confident, individual who I don't think really put a lot of, I don't think he would have had problems doing it. I'm surprised that he didn't. He was a fairly self-confident guy. If I remember correctly, he said, I don't want that guy to resign on me. I want the son of a bitch fired. I mean, I think he would have been very, confident.
Well, by then, that's where he is.
Yeah, I just want to add one more thing. That as you mentioned, that he was not only a general in that time, but also he was in charge of occupying and controlling Japan. In that time, his nickname in Japan was Emperor with Blue Eyes, which is like a really powerful figure. And I guess that he really enjoyed to be seen as an emperor in Japan. As far as I know, during the Korean War, he never stayed overnight in Korea because every night he flew back to Tokyo, and he really enjoyed life in Tokyo. So I simply think that that kind of figure, I don't think he's appropriate to lead a world that never stayed in the battlefield. Every time go back to the luxury life in Tokyo.
Yeah,
that's just my point.
Yeah, so you're in the Matt Williams school. Get rid of the guy early on. It is, by the way, what you point out is really it's true and it's really interesting. He does not. I think he visits once. When he goes, he does not stay. Now MacArthur was a very brave guy. I mean, he was famous for his courage in the First World War. But by the way, his pattern of behavior was the same during in the Philippines in World War II. The troops called him Dugout Doug, which was not a compliment. He spends the whole time in Corregidor. He doesn't really go out to the Bataan Peninsula where, they're fighting for his life. So there's something a little bit strange because it was not lack of physical courage. Okay, so we've been talking about whether you would fire him, why you would fire him. And there, I think one of the things that's interesting about the discussion thus far is there are some of you who feel, look, he's tremendously talented, keep him as long as you can, and then if you have to, fire him. There are some of you who feel, look, actually, fundamentally, this is not the right guy, and you should just get rid of him. You probably should have got, if you could have gotten rid of him, when you came on board, that would have been the best thing. And there may be an argument to say, you just don't want to have this guy out there forever. There's then the question of actually of how Truman is going to play this. And I want to give you, I'm going to distribute two other documents, and I'll give you just 5 minutes to read them. The first is April 19th, 1951. It's a Pentagon statement, just make sure I've got my own copy here, on the relief of General MacArthur, which in a way speaks to the issue of Truman's self-confidence. So if you just take that and pass it. And then the other is it's a memo for Averill Harriman, Murphy, company. So in other words, this is to other members of Truman's staff by George Elsie. George Elsie was an administrative assistant to Truman. He's about 33, I guess, at this point. He had served in the Naval Reserve throughout World War II. He's now a reserve commander in the Navy. But basically, he's the guy who runs the map room, which was the equivalent of today's Situation Room. And he's giving some essentially political advice about how to manage MacArthur. So why don't we just take a quick minute to look at that. I'm actually going to I'll read the Pentagon statement. So, it's a statement issued by the Pentagon April 19th, just a few days after MacArthur's relief. In response to inquiries from the press concerning General MacArthur's reference to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a Pentagon spokesman said that the White House had authorized him to state that the action taken by the president in relieving General MacArthur was based upon the unanimous recommendations of the president's principal civilian and military advisors, including the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The reasons for General MacArthur's relief have been stated previously by the president. Well, what do we think about that? Megan?
I think it was important for President Truman that, you know, a statement was released that said, you know, this wasn't just Truman going off on his own, that this was both recommended and supported.
Okay, so before this is issued, let's assume Truman has fired not only Derek, he's fired Matt, too. And so you're now the advisor. Would you have recommended that the Pentagon release this, make this statement?
I would not release it. It says that they released it in response to inquiries, and I think that's appropriate. Otherwise, I don't really think that there needs to be a public statement saying that, yeah, we support what the president just said.
Laura?
I mean, this statement to me totally says why MacArthur had to be fired. I mean, there's no way that Truman was ever going to get this guy back in the box if this is how he's going to deal with this.
I
feel like this is such a weak statement. I mean, the president isn't coming out. He's, you know, saying that, no, this is what I was also told to do. It's, you know, multiple layers of reference to clearing and all of this. And so I just feel like someone like that had no choice but to fire Truman, no choice but to fire MacArthur.
Right, so that MacArthur doesn't fire Truman.
Right.
Yeah.
I just don't think that, you know, this is any sort of way to handle that.
Yeah, Lori.
I think this memo undermines what it's ostensibly trying to say, because it says that the White House had authorized him to state. It doesn't say that, like, the White House and the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Pentagon had authorized him to state. It says specifically the White House had authorized him to state. So it almost suggests that there's a lack of unity.
The buck stops here.
Nick?
This is just bureaucratic weasel words. I mean...
say that again?
This is just a bunch of weasel words. I mean, I would read from this that, well, do the Joint Chiefs really support the President's actions? I mean, I just... There's a bunch of bureaucratic words in here that kind of say, yeah, we do, you know, support what the President's done, but, you know, talk to him about why he's done it, which says to me that really deep down they're like, they're pretty indifferent about the whole firing, so they would have been better off not putting this out, because I think this actually muddies the waters rather than clarifies the position of senior military leaders.
Chris?
I read it completely differently, actually. I read it as, period, okay? The president stated why he fired him. He did it with the unanimous recommendations, whether or not that's true, of his principal civilian and military advisors and the Joint Chiefs. We don't need to restate it. You know, situation's closed, book is done, president's made his decision.
Interesting. Does anybody just read it as weakness? Kelly?
Actually, after Chris's original comment about kind of assessing Truman, this had been my thought, that I had seen in the reading that we had this week, I kind of had a new view of Truman as more bluster, I think, than necessarily action. And like the part about when he sent when they told MacArthur that he had to send all his correspondence back to D.C., and he did. They kind of looked at it and said, oh, we have this slight change, but you can carry on doing correspondence just kind of in light of this change, and not really that he wouldn't right. hold him to a line, it seemed like. And so this kind of seems similar of being more, it does undermine his authority, I think, in that it shouldn't require extra explanation if you just say the guy's fired.
Right. Well, I mean, I think there's a really important point here, which is our image of Truman. We have historical images of these people. The image of MacArthur is now quite a negative one, and that's why I made an effort to kind of bring you back in a little bit into the mood of the time when he's this towering figure. Our picture of Truman is incredibly positive, and it should be in many ways. I mean, there are a lot of things about Truman that are quite brilliant, but you can overdo that. And I mean, at least the way I would just tell you the way I read this is. This is really weak. You know, if the president has to say, well, all my advisors said I need to do this, that's not a good sign. Now, of course, the amount of trouble that they're in is indicated by this. And this is in May. This is a month and a half later. Shows you the news cycle then was a little bit longer. And, right, this is not the age of CNN, not even the age of C-SPAN. And here he's getting some confidential advice. They're very, say, we're very disturbed, very disturbing statistics from Gallup. And he says, and then he concludes, George Elsie does, "It seems to me that we cannot afford to slack off in our constant emphasis and reiteration that MacArthur stood for war and the president stands for peace. This and this alone will sink in with the general public." Well, technical arguments about civilian control won't mean a thing to the people at large. How many of you would agree with that last sentence? How many of you would disagree with that last sentence? Has to be the rest of you, I mean, unless you're... Cole. Gotcha. Well, I'll teach you to put your hand up, yeah.
Well, simply in the McChrystal case, I think that it, when Obama fired him, it was seen as the assertion of civilian leadership over military insubordination, and that helped his case. Oh. So I tend to see these as, you know, related examples, and so it's hard for me to see it the other way.
Connor?
But McChrystal wasn't someone like, say, Petraeus. But I can't imagine Obama trying to kick out Petraeus because he said something to the Rolling Stone. Admittedly, I don't think he would have.
Well, that's a really interesting proposition. That's a really interesting question. Nobody else had heard of. I mean, I think there may be something to what you say. I think the... Megan doesn't. No. You think they would have fired... They would have fired Petraeus just as easily?
Well, I have a difficult time imagining General Petraeus or any of his staff members being on record as saying,
bite me. Guy.
Right. But all the same, I don't think that President Obama would have hesitated to fire General Petraeus had he made similar comments to the Rolling Stone. I don't think that granted, General McChrystal had been previously admonished, I guess is maybe the right word, for remarks at the IISS question and answer period, et cetera. But I still don't think that – I think President Obama set a tone where he wasn't exactly going to brook that sort of public discourse with general officers.
Do you think he would have fired General McChrystal today or June of 2012?
You mean had the Rolling Stone issue not happened, or just
maybe he would have. And I think actually I wrote an op-ed saying that alas, General McChrystal had to go, and I have enormous regard for General McChrystal, enormous. And I saw him do his thing, and it was remarkable. But I think, you know, the point of the two documents I just gave you is don't assume that politicians are heroic on these matters. And, I mean, even Truman, firing MacArthur was a huge, huge deal. It was a huge deal, and the Republicans were quite ready to run with it. And if MacArthur had been more politically adroit, MacArthur might well have run with it. And there were a lot of people who thought, you know, MacArthur, could easily end up running for president, or that would be a huge problem. Politicians are very careful about this kind of thing. And, I mean, in the case of McChrystal, I think the offense was clear enough, and as was, he took some heat. Whether he would have been willing to do the same sort of thing with Petraeus, whether he would have been willing to do the same thing at a different time, I don't know. I can't be 100% convinced.
I have a question about the second memo at first glance. It seems to be giving political advice, yet it's coming from the equivalent of the Situation Room, from a naval officer.
Uh-huh.
What's going on?
He had been in the Situation Room in the past, the map room.
Right.
He left in 1946.
Right. Well, it's kind of a murky world out there.
True.
But also, I mean, it's also interesting how, well, he, at this point, he's a reserve officer. And this does get to some, you know, civil-military relations issues. But he is thinking like a, he is thinking. He's clearly thinking politically about how to cast this. And you know, do you think any political operative, Democrat or Republican, would think about the problem very differently?
No.
I don't think so. Yeah, there are a lot of things we can talk about. I just want to talk about for the last 5 minutes. I mean, I think you know the basic diagnosis we've got here is right, which is MacArthur gets fired for a whole bunch of things. Most of which are talking about foreign policy issues. Actually, as it turns out, most of them are about Taiwan and sort of broader issues of China. Tremendous friction with Acheson, who, of course, is one of Truman's favorites. It is not really for exceeding his remit in terms of actual military command, doing things on the ground. So I also gave you a handout, which includes an interview with General Dempsey with Fareed Zakaria on GPS just from a couple weeks ago, in which he's basically saying he talks about two things. He talks about Iran and he talks about Syria. And the first question is about Zakaria says, what would you say to those who argued the United States should arm the opposition movement in Syria? Dempsey, I think it's premature to take a decision to arm the opposition movement in Syria, because I would challenge anyone to clearly identify for me the opposition movement in Syria at this point. And then later on, he talks about Iran. He says, well, it's premature to make a decision about the use of military force. Should he have said those things? Now, those things, by the way, I think are completely in line with administration policy. So let's at least stipulate that. Should General Dempsey say those things? Dean.
I mean, ideally, he would have just said no comment or I'm not at liberty to speak about this. But as it was, he really didn't give an answer. He said, it's premature. We're not really talking about this. Well, even though they obviously are.
Well, it's saying we should make, I mean, in international politics, a decision not to act is a decision. Kelly?
My initial thought had been, but then he followed it up saying, but as the military, yeah, we will provide options if we are asked to provide options, right, which I think is the right message. But then I don't know if he should have stated originally his opinion and then gone to that, because that does kind of color the discussion after that.
Cole?
I think that this reflects, for better or worse, that the role of the chairman has become something of a political advocate for the president. And I can't help but believe that if McCain were president, for example, if Chairman Dempsey would have said, actually, we know who the Syrian opposition is, and there are more that we can arm them, and it would be effective.
I'll stipulate that that's the case. I'm not saying it is, but I'm going to stipulate that that's the case for the purpose of discussion. Should that trouble us? The issue is civil-military relations. Last 2 minutes. Josh?
I think you've introduced a spectrum. I think, and you can certainly defend the fact that it should trouble us, because if you say it shouldn't, then you're supporting automatons. Potentially, where it shouldn't trouble us is because our professional military is not in the business of making policy, and in between those two things.
Is it or isn't it?
I don't think it should be. But now, I mean, there's instances. One thing I just thought about while we were talking, you know, he's taking an interview. So don't take the interview if you're not going to have a discussion. I think he walked a line. I think he walked it fine. I mean, at that level, they are sworn to give their opinion to Congress.
Right.
Every time they go before Congress, it's not... They're sworn not to speak.
Yeah, they're not sworn to speak to Fareed Zakaria, but
right. But in another context, you could say that's making policy,
right,
and potentially it is. Right. And they're sworn to do that instead of following a party line. So it's a gray area, maybe.
I'm going to give Laura the last word, because I could tell she was about to leap out of her chair there.
No. I mean, I think that the chairman and the... I mean, thinking back to like the Afghan strategy review, I mean, the chairman and the vice chairman ultimately presented some different options to the president. So I think the idea that the chairman operates only as sort of a mouthpiece of the administration is, you know, perhaps slightly overblown, but there's also no way that he took the interview without talking to the White House, without having every single, you know, talking point cleared. So, I mean, I think that is difficult on some level, but if that is part of, you know, if
you know, sort of military is going to be the ultimate end of your diplomatic efforts potentially, then having that as part of the conversation from the beginning I don't think is, you know, inherently bad.
Okay, let me, I'm going to just to try to pull all this together. So look, we're not going to have another Truman MacArthur in that way. First, I don't think you're going to ever have somebody who has the incredible kind of reputation that MacArthur had. You're not going to have somebody who spent 14 years overseas in quite that way, who is so much more senior than all the other military people, with the exception of Marshall, who almost kind of recuses himself, that you know, the chief of staff of the Army or even the chairman of the Joint Chiefs find it hard to approach him as a subordinate. I don't think that's going to happen. You may or may not get that kind of outsized personality. I'm not so sure. Technology makes some difference. How much, I'm not sure. But having said that, you know, as we saw with the McChrystal case, or even in a much milder way with Dempsey, who is, by the way, a consummate professional, and was being very careful. Like kinds of issues are going to come up, because in the modern age, it's actually impossible, I think, for a chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to avoid talking to Fareed Zakaria, let alone Congress. And they're going to have to deal with foreign policy issues. And that's not going to be true just, I think, at the level of chairman. I think it's going to be true much, much further down as well. So I don't think these issues are, they may get more subtle, but I don't think they're going to go away. Great class. See you all next week.
Next week on Lectures in History, Professor William Cooper discusses the idea of honor in the antebellum South. The class is from Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge. Join us each Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. for classroom lectures from across the country on different topics and eras of American history. Lectures in History are also available as podcasts. Visit our website at cspan.org/history/podcasts or download them from iTunes.